Hello and welcome once again to canonblogger.com. You're listening to episode number 58. In this week's episode, I will be talking to you about the latest sensation hit photography, and that is the activity of photo walks. You'll also hear about Adobe's life cycle of products, seeing as they just released the Creative Suite 4 version of Photoshop and the entire Creative Suite of programs. Last but not least, I will also take some listener questions and hopefully provide some coherent answers for you. And of course, we'll round out this week's episode with another photo road tip, a tip to take you into next week's episode. So thanks for tuning in, and here comes episode number 58. And welcome once again to another episode of canonblogger.com. In this week's episode, I'm going to be talking to you about the latest sensation really to hit the photography industry, and that is the activity of photo walks. And just to set this up a little bit and let you know why this subject has come about, roughly 2 or 3 months ago, Scott Kelby of NAPP fame, which stands for the National Association of Photoshop Professionals, held a worldwide photo walk where he was promoting his newest book about Photoshop Lightroom 2.0, I believe, and he decided to hold a worldwide photo walk. And for those of you who don't know, a photo walk is just that. It's a gathering of photographers or of people who are interested in photography, and they get together and they take a walk around a specified pre-planned route and just take pictures of what ever strikes their interest, and it's really a great way to network and join with the camaraderie of other people who enjoy the same interests that you do, in this case obviously being photography, and it's a great way to really learn about not only others but about yourself and what drives you and what motivates you, and it can really give you a burst of creativity to be around others that share the same interests and hobbies that you do. So anyway, back on track, Scott Kelby held this photo walk, and from that photo walk spawned many more regional and local photo walks. I know there had been others going on all around the United States. I remember seeing some dialogues about photo walks that were taking place in Boston. Some were taking place in Virginia. An individual by the name of Jeff Revell, had been conducting photo walks in his area of Virginia, and he happened to know Scott Kelby, and I think that's part of what generated this latest craze inside the photography industry. When I was back in South Carolina, I was a co-founder of a photo group, and we didn't use the term photo walk, we called them walkabouts, but conceptually it was pretty much the same thing, where a group of photographers would get together, take a walk around a designated area, share pictures and techniques and thoughts with one another. And again, it's really just a great way to enjoy the camaraderie and share interest that you have with others who share that interest, whether it be photography in general, photography gear, photography techniques, photography software, photography news and developments, whatever happens to strike your fancy, you can usually find people who share the same interests if you have a walking event where you can talk to others that are also interested in the same thing. Well, in Denver, Colorado, just this last weekend, we had our first photo walk that was post Scott Kelby. So we do have to give shout outs to Scott Kelby, thanking him for providing us the motivation to actually unite and form our own group inside the Denver, Colorado area. And as a preface to our photo walk, which just took place, you can go to www.meetup.com, and I believe our group number is 801 for the Denver Photo Walk group. And we also have a companion group page over at flickr.com, which I'm sure many of us are familiar with. And if you just search for the Denver Photo Walk group on Flickr, you can see member images there that we've contributed. So we had our first photo walk just this last Saturday. I was actually the assistant organizer for this photo walk because the organizer had some other things going on. So I set up this outing and specified the planned route and also get allowed time afterwards for those of us who were interested to sit down at a local restaurant and enjoy a bite to eat, get to know one another better, things of that nature. And it really was an enjoyable event. Met a lot of really nice people that had similar interests, similar backgrounds, similar perspectives on photography, and also learned quite a bit about some other people in the area. And we're very excited about this new photo walk group that we've created here in Denver. So I would like to encourage you inside this podcast to seek out photo walking groups in your own neck of the woods. If you happen to be an organizer or are already participating in a photo walk in your area, please let me know. Let me know what kinds of things you do on your photo walks, what kinds of areas you go to, what kinds of activities you have planned. We're a little bit in the discussion phase of whether or not we should be including contests, things of that nature, and making more of a directed path as opposed to just a free-for-all. And right now we're kind of in the learning phases to figure out what will work best for the dynamics of this group. But I would be interested in hearing what other people are doing when it comes to photo walking activities. So if you do have any ideas, comments, feedback, things you would like to share with me, you can share those comments on the blog over at www.canonblogger.com. And you can also email me directly at jason@canonblogger.com. And I do try to reply to all emails and at least acknowledge all the comments that show up on the blog. So do stop over and let me know your thoughts, feedback, and comments on photo walking in other areas. Because not only can we learn from one another inside of a group, but groups can learn from one another as well, insofar as what would make for a successful photo walk versus what would not do so well inside of photo walks. And of course, this will vary from one group to another depending on the dynamics, but there are certain key formulas that will work pretty much universally. So do feel free to stop by the blog or email me and share your thoughts. Coming up in the next segment of CanonBlogger.com, I'll be talking about the Adobe lifecycle of products. So stay tuned to hear my little diatribe or discussion on that subject as well. And we are back with the second segment of the CanonBlogger.com podcast number 58. And in this segment, I will be sharing my thoughts on the Adobe lifecycle of products. And it sounds like an interesting discussion, I'm sure, or hopefully it sounds like an interesting discussion, because Adobe just came out with their most recent iteration of Photoshop in the form of Creative Suite 4. And of course, there are other programs that are associated with the Creative Suite or group of applications, but the one that, of course, most photographers will find an interest in is that of the Photoshop program. Now, and I believe this is its 10th iteration or 11th iteration. I honestly don't remember. I started using it after they started the moniker of Creative Suite. I started with Creative Suite 2 and am now debating, and actually now have, Creative Suite 3 Extended. And I'm debating whether or not I really need to make the move to the Creative Suite 4 edition, since it's only been about 12 to 18 months since CS3 came out. And it's kind of an interesting idea here behind software development and the need for it. Because if you think about software development, what software programmers will do is they'll develop a piece of software, and then they will elicit feedback from the community of people that use that software. And based on the feedback they get, they will either do bug fixes or they'll do patches or updates. And if they start seeing a growing trend for an interest in things that they just can't patch, what they will then do is release a new version of the software to give people more of what they want to see inside the software application. And this pretty much holds true regardless of what program you're talking about, whether it be Photoshop, whether it be Microsoft Office, whether it be a web browser, or any other program that people use on a regular basis. And what's interesting about this is the life cycle that Adobe has decided to adopt for generating new versions of their software programs. And by and large, if you look at the Adobe life cycle of products, in general, they follow about an 18-month life cycle. So what that means is as soon as they release a version of Photoshop or any of their Creative Suite applications, they immediately start working on the next version. And I guess what strikes me as interesting about that is it becomes a question of what is really driving the development of the next version of the program, because it seems like they might be starting to be looking less and less at what the users of the program want and more start looking at generating future revenue. And before I get a bunch of emails, don't get me wrong, I'm very much a capitalist and believe in the value of research and development and pushing new versions of products, especially when warranted, and that people who invest a lot in research and development of new programming and new features in software deserve to be compensated for their efforts. But the whole question becomes one of whether or not new versions of programs are really needed on such a short window. Because with only 12 to 18 months in a program application's life cycle, if it takes you 6 months to really start getting all the new features down and understandable, and then another 6 months to get them into your workflow on a consistent basis, then you're really only using the program efficiently and effectively for roughly 6 months before you have to upgrade again. And if we're talking about upgrading from CS3 to CS4 at a cost of $20 to $30 or maybe even $50, like some things do, like TurboTax, for example, you have to get a new version of TurboTax every year, and that usually costs about $50 to $75, depending on the version that you get. And it's built-in obsolescence, almost. It's kind of like the light bulb, where it's designed to lose its effectiveness over time. And software programs, by their very nature, also follow this same approach in their development. And it really becomes a question of whether or not this kind of development is needed on such a short time frame, because if you're only using it for 6 months, when you have to turn around after 6 months and put out another $200 to $600 out of your own pocket to get the newest version, it really can almost become counterproductive to keep updating your software every 18 months. So these are the thoughts that I've been having about the Adobe lifecycle of products. And I know I have seen a lot of research out there that suggests that there are enough updates and fixes and patches and bugs and things of that nature that are corrected, as well as new features that are added to increase user productivity. For those of us that are not on the cutting edge, that really don't use programs to their complete fullest extent and aren't screaming for new features all the time, that may be something to consider before making an investment from one software application suite to another software application, where you're investing pretty large chunks of money at a single clip. So those are the thoughts that I was having on the Adobe life cycle of 18 months, specifically for their Photoshop family, the Creative Suite 3 to the Creative Suite 4. But I would also like to hear from you, dear listeners. So if you do have an interest in this discussion and would like to share your thoughts and feedback, you can always email your comments to me. And my address is jason@canonblogger.com. And you can also stop into the blog. And the blog is also over at www.canonblogger.com. And I would encourage you to feel free to jump into the mix and contribute to the discussion. And if you have thoughts that you would like to share on the air, please feel free to email me. There are options such as Skype available, where we could actually get a dialogue going on rather than just one person talking. So if anyone is so inclined, you can email me. You can set up a time to talk about things on Skype, and you can hear yourself on a future episode of canonblogger.com. Or, as always, you can share your thoughts, comments, and feedback in the comments section of the blog over at canonblogger.com. So that is pretty much going to wrap up my discussion of the Adobe software lifecycle of products. In the next segment, I will take a few listener questions and hopefully give you some coherent answers to them. So please stay tuned, and we'll see you back here in 30 seconds. So welcome back to the final segment for the Canon Blogger episode number 58 podcast. In this segment, I'm going to be taking a couple listener questions and hopefully giving some coherent answers to you here inside the podcast. The first one comes from Chip in South Carolina. Chip emailed me a week or two ago and asked me what the difference was between SD flashcards and SDHC flashcards. And you're seeing SD flashcards making their way into the SLR realm much more than they used to. Primarily, they used to be in the point-and-shoot arena of photography and much smaller devices, but now you're starting to see them making more of an inroad into the SLR families, as SLRs are starting to offer multiple options where you can write the raw file to one card, usually a compact flash card, and then the smaller JPEG file to an SD card. And Chip writes in asking about the difference between SD cards and SDHC cards. Well, SD stands for Secure Digital, and if you look at an SD card, on the right side of the SD card, there will be a little toggle that you can push forward or push back. And if you push that toggle forward, any data that's been recorded to that card, whether that data is in the form of an image, in the form of audio, in the form of video, or just in the form of other data, whether it's Word files, Excel files, any kind of data that gets recorded on there. If you move that toggle forward, that card will now be locked, so it's secured, and that you cannot overwrite or accidentally erase data that's been put on that card. And it's a pretty handy feature to have. So that is what the SD stands for in Secure Digital. Secure meaning you can lock it down. And that option isn't available in other types of flash media like compact flash cards. Now, the HC portion of his question stands for high capacity. And a high capacity card, I believe, the way I understand it, is any card that is over 4 gigabytes of data. So if you see an 8 gigabyte card that could be specified as a high capacity card, or a 16 gigabyte card, that would also be considered a high capacity card. But SD and SDHC really simply is an acronym for the type of media card that you have. And you will usually see SD hit its limit at around 4 gigabytes, and SDHC will kick in at the 8 megabyte range, going up to the 8, 16, and 32 quantity levels, where it redoubles in size. So that answers Chip's question. Chip, thank you very much for writing in. I hope the answer I provided you was an accurate one and a helpful one. Our next question comes to us from Gene, and I hope I'm pronouncing this right, in Petaluma, California. P-E-T-A-L-U-M-A. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. If I'm not, and someone knows, if they could write in, share a comment, or email me, I will make sure to get that pronunciation corrected. If someone could say yes or no whether Petaluma is correct. But anyway, Gene writes in from Petaluma, California, and he asked a really good question about displaying your photographs on a television set. And it's a great question because we often don't think about this, but it would be very useful if we could take our pictures from our computer or our laptop or our camera and plug them into a TV. So instead of having everyone hovered around a computer monitor, unless you've got a super big monitor, of course, it can be a very useful feature to resize your pictures and plug them into a TV so that you can show family photos or trip shots from your vacation or share them with a wider audience rather than around a monitor or on the web. And it's a really good question because you do have to change the resolution for your images to display correctly on your television monitor. And a lot of new monitors these days, especially the digital monitors and the HD TV monitors, are touting different resolution rates. And you really want to check with the vendor and your specific television to look at what the resolution is for that particular set. Because whatever resolution that set is configured for will be the resolution that you want to set your pictures to. And if you're looking at the HD TVs, you are usually going to see one of two resolutions, and that's going to be 1080p or 720p. And the 1080p and the 720p refer to the pixels per million or whatever the acronym is. But the 1080 and the 720 refer to the resolution size on the wide end. So that's going left to right, because there usually are widescreen TVs. So you want to make sure that your resolution is set in your photos to match the resolution on your TV, and that will give you the most optimal quality in your photo presentations that you share in that particular venue. And all you have to do to get to that end is take the resolution of whatever your television is set to and enter those dimensions in the options bar from your crop tab inside of Photoshop, and it will restrict your aspect ratio to that aspect ratio of your television. So that is another good way to make sure that your pictures are optimized for displaying on televisions, is to make sure that you've got the resolution set and the aspect ratio set correctly. Great question from Gene. Thank you very much. And if I am off base, someone please let me know, but that is the way it has been told or explained to me in the past, so I do hope I'm getting that right. And moving on to our last question of the day here, this comes from Karen right here in Denver, and Karen asks an interesting question about what types of interface devices you use with Photoshop, or she asks what kind I use with Photoshop, and she's referring specifically to the mouse versus the trackpad versus the tablet type of interface. And I wanted to thank Karen for writing in and asking her question. And this is really another great question, too, because this will kind of be framed by how you prefer to work. If you're used to a mouse and you've always used a mouse, there will always be a learning period if you ever try to migrate from the mouse to a trackball or from the mouse to a trackpad or the mouse to a tablet. Because it's a different way of communicating with your cursor. And your cursor will do different things and have different functions in each device. And by the same token, you will also be able to exert more control over your cursor as you migrate up in the device type. So the mouse will be the least effective, or the least sensitive, I should say, to different inputs and functionalities that it can perform. If you move up to a trackball pad or a trackpad, those can exert more control over the mouse. You can set pressure, you can have more precise definition in the movement of your cursor. And then of course at the high end, you can have the tablets, which will exert the most control and have the most specific and most defined control of your cursor as you move around. And I presume she's talking about inside of images when you edit your software. And it's a really good question because I have tried the trackball pads unsuccessfully. I didn't like them very much. and I have also used the tablet feature. So I've got a Wacom Cintiq tablet, which is one of the biggest ones that they make at the office that I use for work. And I'm getting better at using it, but I still do revert back to the mouse occasionally. And I have a feeling I would probably enjoy it more and enjoy the control more if I just abandoned the mouse completely. But because I have worked with a mouse for so long, it's more of a difficult migration for me. And of course, this will vary from one person to the next. So depending on how easily you might make the transition or how much more difficult the transition is for you, your mileage could vary depending on what ways you learn best and how quickly you can adapt to new situations. So that is a great question. I want to thank everyone for taking the time to either write in comments on the blog or email comments to me directly. It's great to hear reader feedback, reader questions, because that means people are actually listening. And that's one of the things that gets me most excited about doing this weekly podcast. So if you do have questions that you would like to hear answers to, or if you would like to hear me guess on an answer to a question on an upcoming episode of Canon Blogger podcast series, you can also email those to me. As I've said before, the address is jason@canonblogger.com, or you can leave your questions inside the comments section and you can get answers quickly that way as well. I do try to respond to every question, whether it's in the comments or in the email, with an answer to the best of my abilities. And if I ever am off base or something's not exactly right, I would encourage others to also chime in if you happen to notice something where my knowledge base isn't as complete as it otherwise might be without the readers that are out there who tune in from one week to the next. So that wraps up the question and answer session of this week's edition of Canon Blogger podcast series. Coming up in our final segment, I'm going to share with you a little photo road tip. So do stop back in to listen to that. And for the final tip in this week's episode of the Canon Blogger podcast series, I'm going to share with you a method I use for sharpening my photos inside of Photoshop. I've seen some other people talk about this, and I've been using it for some time myself with varying degrees of success depending on the type of image. But if you do your Camera Raw sharpening, and that's inside of the Adobe Camera Raw dialog, and you add a little sharpening inside of there, and you still haven't gotten the level of sharpness that you'd like to get in your photos, you can use plugins to accomplish some more defined sharpening. Nick Define is a good one. But one method that I use inside of Photoshop that, like I said, I've used with some success is that of the overpass filter inside of Photoshop. And what you would need to do is create a duplicate layer. You can do that by pressing Command or Control J on your keyboard, and that'll create a duplicate layer of the layer that you're on. On that layer, you would want to convert that. You would want to run that high pass filter on your top level image, and then once that's been completed, you want to change the layer type to overlay, and that way you can actually see more sharpness inside your image. And I find a value on the high pass filter that usually works is anywhere between 1 and 2.3 to 2.5. I know some people that like to crank it up higher than that, going as high as 5 or 6 or maybe even 7 inside the high pass filter dialog, and then simply adjust the opacity on that layer after they've applied the sharpening, and you can get varying degrees of success with that as well. But the high pass filter is my little photo road tip for the week. Do feel free to try that inside of Photoshop and share your thoughts with me on how useful that is with your photography. And do also let me know what kind of photography you shoot. So if we find that it works more for portrait work and less for landscape work, that could be something we could share in a future episode of the Canon Blogger podcast series. So that pretty much wraps things up for this week. I've talked to you about a couple items that have been of interest to me that I wanted to share with you, as well as some listener questions and the photo road tip. If you do have ideas for future segments that you would like to hear, or if you have questions you would like answered, or if you have questions about Photoshop even that may be useful as a photo road tip, please feel free to email me. The address, as always, is jason@canonblogger.com. And do stop into the blog over at www.canonblogger.com to see the latest photos and activities that I'm sharing from the blog header and from the polls that I'm featuring on the sidebar from time to time, because the content there does change. So you really can't get everything from Canon Blogger just by visiting the weekly podcast. Granted, that is a pretty interesting portion, or I guess the most interesting portion of the site, because it is an audio thing that you can take with you, but there is other stuff available. A couple other things that you may not have noticed over on the blog are a couple new features that I have linked to inside the header, including the online photography test, the colors and textures album, as well as links to my own personal photography projects that I've have posted online for other people's viewing pleasure. So do stop into the blog to check out those links, see the polls, see the pictures that I have featured in the blog header, which usually changes every day during the work week from Monday through Friday, and share your thoughts on that as well. If you have something you would like to share with me either via comment or email, you are always free to do so. So that pretty much wraps things up for this week. Thank you once again for tuning in, and we'll see you next week on episode number 59 of the CanonBlogger.com podcast series. Happy shooting, and we'll see you then. Bye.